Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
AAA, AA, how much difference would a downgrade really mean, do you think? And from our China series, the five-year plan, the rewards and risks of upward mobility. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Carbonite Business, providing automatic online backup solutions for small businesses. Learn more and receive a free trial at Carbonite.com with code Marketplace.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's the 14th of July today. It's a Thursday. Glad, as always, to have you with us. The 2nd of August this year comes on a Tuesday, so that gives us just over 2.5 weeks to figure out what to do about the debt limit. And by us, of course, I mean politicians in Washington. But it's entirely possible that the negotiations are about to be taken out of their hands. Moody's, the credit rating agency, has joined Standard & Poor's in suggesting that America's AAA credit score might be at risk if there is no deal to be done. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore has the story.
Ernest Hemingway's friends once asked him how he went broke. His answer? Slowly, then all at once. The U.S. is in the same boat. We may not be able to pay our bills come August 2nd. Moody's and S&P are threatening to downgrade us. Again. It sounds bad, but our financial troubles are just beginning, says Robert Tipp. He's the chief investment strategist for Prudential Fixed Income.
I think it's a slow burn. I think getting downgraded a tick is not a disaster. It's undesirable.
Tipp said the U.S. has never been downgraded, even though we've been borrowing for years and have no credible plan to pay it off. So I asked Chris Whalen, a well-known financial analyst, what investors who hold U.S. bonds could do if America defaults.
Where are they going to run if the Treasury is late paying its debts? They got nowhere to run. If we're a few days late, the world will not end. People will wait.
A day after Moody's threat, investors aren't acting as if they're worried. Today, investors couldn't get enough of the new 30-year Treasury bonds. Whalen believes the credit agencies are bluffing. He says Moody's and S&P know that if we go down, we'll be taking everybody else with us.
All that will happen is if they downgrade the U.S., the whole market will be downgraded because everybody trades off the U.S.
That's because we're still the biggest economy on Earth. And the dollar is not just our currency, it's the world's currency. Central banks have trillions to invest, and they do that mainly in dollars. But maybe they won't do that forever. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Tuition's going up at the University of California. The nearly 10% bump was approved this afternoon. And actually, tuition is known as fees in this state. But whatever you call it, it'll mean an extra $1,000 or so per student on top of an increase approved last year. The extra money is going to help offset huge cuts in state funding for higher education in the state of California. And the same thing is happening in much of the rest of the country as well. From the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Amy Scott reports.
For the first time, the UC system will get more revenue from tuition than from the state.
What we've had is just a huge offloading of costs from the state to the students and their families in California.
That's Patrick Callen with the National Center for Public Policy and Higher Education. The same shift is happening around the country. A new report says 35 states have cut higher education funding this fiscal year. Florida, Louisiana, Illinois, Colorado, all have raised tuition lately. Just this week, the California State University system approved another 12% increase. Lauren Asher is president of the nonprofit Institute for College Access and Success. She says in California, a third of the money from tuition increases goes to financial aid.
Net price, the cost of college after available aid in California, is still lower than in most of the rest of the country, especially for low and moderate income students.
But others say rising tuition will force more students out of four-year colleges and into lower-cost community colleges that are already maxed out. David Brenneman is an education economist at the University of Virginia. He says as state universities have looked elsewhere for revenue, they haven't done enough to reduce costs.
We've been pushing every conceivable revenue source now for two decades. And the one place where people have, you know, not taken as aggressive a stance is to say, you know, exactly how and where can we make some serious long-term changes in the way we do things.
Brenneman says one answer may be technology. That could mean offering more classes online. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
I'm not yet among the lucky millions who've been invited to join Google Plus. They're intentionally limiting admission to maintain some kind of cool factor, I guess. Whatever. They've also banned businesses so far, but it seems all those users are just too juicy to ignore. Today, Google said it's going to open things up to select members of the corporate world next week. Marketplace's Steve Henn has that story.
There's no faster way to kill a budding social network than by flooding it with spammy, annoying messages.
This person joined you on Google+. That person joined you on Google+.
Josh Burnoff wrote the social marketing guide Groundswell. He says, so far, Google's had a good launch, but opening the network to businesses is risky.
I'm reminded of the quip that Yogi Berra supposedly made about a restaurant where he says, nobody goes there anymore, it's just too crowded.
Facebook grew into the biggest social network in the world by limiting ads early on and trying to stay hip. But things have changed, says Michael Gartenberg at Gartner Research.
People have come to expect the idea of brands associated with social networks. They've come to accept the idea of social commerce.
And giants like Google and Facebook have come to depend on it. There's a reason Facebook's valued at almost $100 billion. But Google Plus is taking it slow. The social network will open its doors to a couple hundred businesses next week. Being among them will be harder than landing a spot on American Idol. Here's Gartenberg.
For businesses, it's a great time to get on, to learn what Google is doing, to get involved with the ecosystem at an early stage before perhaps their competitors.
But just like American Idol, there's a chance you'll embarrass yourself in front of millions. Josh Burnoff says for now, Google Plus is for the lucky and the brave.
Well, you know, you're staking a claim in an unexplored continent, and you don't know if the first step that you take is going to lead you to a big trove of gold or a pit of alligators.
Businesses have until tomorrow to apply. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, traders had it going on this morning, and then they lost their way, thanks mostly to Ben Bernanke walking back his, sure, we could do more stimulus comments from yesterday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The next time somebody tries to tell you that China's not a market economy, tell them this story. See what they say. Every Saturday, in a corner of People's Park in Shanghai, people, mostly mothers, show up with flyers and resumes and a stool, and they set up shop. Trees and benches and walls, even the walkways, are covered with what are basically want ads. It's parents looking for a suitable match for their kids. It's called Zhonghun, marriage seating, and not apparently always something that folks there want to talk about. No pictures, she says, pushing my microphone away. Her daughter would be too humiliated, she tells me. The whole thing is amazingly well organized. Parents can search for prospective matches by birth year, by height, by geographic location. And after some looking, I finally find a mom willing to explain the whole thing to me. It's a place, she says, where parents look for love for their children. Her daughter is 27. She's a designer, totally fine with mom doing the matchmaking. Or so mom says. So long as she winds up with a guy born between 1967 and 1983.
Okay, so she wants... Okay, so she's looking for somebody born 76 to 83, so a little bit older. 1.73 meters to 1.8. 稍等一下，比较高的是吧？ Yeah, she wants tall, right? She wants tall. 对.
5'8" or taller, please. And if there is a match mom likes, the guy gets her phone number. And after that, Mrs. Zhao says, nature has to take its course. This all might seem like a lot to go through just to find your child a date. But even though China is clearly a society in transition from deeply traditional to something much more 21st century, there are still plenty of people here, parents specifically, working with a deadline, get married by 30 or be an old maid.
It's all about family and the very Chinese interpretation of it, Mrs. Zhao tells me.
女孩子在30岁以前吧，生育是优生优育。一般女孩子生育最佳年龄是在27、28岁，30岁以内。
Get married, have kids, support grandma and grandpa in their old age. Now, what does all that have to do with the Chinese real estate bubble and the rising expectations of the middle class? Well, that's our China theme for today. We'll put it all together for you a bit later on in the broadcast. Coming up, yeah, it's great to be a member of the rising Chinese middle class, till it's not.
The ability to just fall and keep on falling down until you touch an absolutely horrible rock bottom is the massive major difference between China as it is at the moment and most of the societies that we come from in the West.
But first, let's do the numbers. Ben Bernanke spoke. The markets groaned and gave back yesterday's gains. The Dow Industrials dropped 54 points, 0.4%. Blue chips ended at 12,437. The NASDAQ slid 34 points, about 1.2%. Closed at 2762. The S&P 500 lost 8 points, 2/3%. Finished at 1308. Tech shares led the declines. Google gave up 1.75% in the regular session. And then after the bell, posted $2.5 billion in quarterly profits. Microsoft blipped down 0.6%. Both Hewlett-Packard and Intel lost 0.8%. Apple and IBM were pretty much flat today. J.P. Morgan banked a 1.8% gain after it reported some positive results. Citigroup and AIG both lost more than 1%. Morgan Stanley and Wells Fargo each lost 0.9%. Today, bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.95%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Business, online automatic backup designed for small businesses. Carbonite Business automatically backs up files to a secure offsite location. In the event of a hard drive crash, virus, or other problem, files can easily be recovered. More information and a free trial by visiting Carbonite.com using the code Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. Are consumers paying more or less for clothes, cars, and other stuff? The Labor Department releases its monthly Consumer Price Index. The Federal Reserve reports on industrial production for June. And Angelino's stockpile supplies in anticipation of a weekend at home, staying clear of the soon-to-be-closed-for-construction 405 freeway. Carmageddon is coming. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. So here's a telling story about China, I think. One night while we were in Shanghai, we took a cab out to the suburbs to meet 24-year-old Randy Tian.
Hello, this is my home. Welcome to it.
He said home, you should think apartment, a small one crowded with five people in it. But it's his. And one could reasonably ask why a 24-year-old single guy needs to own his own place in one of the most expensive cities in the world. So we did.
The most popular thing, the important thing is that I can marry if you have your own apartment. This is China traditional.
If you don't have your own apartment, he said, you can't marry. We double-checked that cultural milepost with financial analyst Jay Wang.
A lot of young people buying the houses not because they like to buy houses, but because they're forced by Chinese culture.
Jay was educated in the U.S., professionally trained on Wall Street, so he knows a little something about bubbles. And now he's back in Shanghai watching it happen all over again in slow motion.
There was real estate bubble in the United States. There's real estate bubble in Europe, right? There was real estate bubble in Japan, in Hong Kong, everywhere, right? China has not experienced a real estate bubble yet. It's unavoidable, right? And I believe it's going to hit China particularly hard.
That may be the case, but you're going to have a tough time convincing Randy Tian. Not only does he own the place he lives in, the marriage apartment, I guess you could call it, he just bought another one. Not worried, though, about a real estate crash.
I think it's impossible, you know. In Shanghai, it's impossible, I think.
Impossible, he said, for there to be a crash.
Have you heard of the housing crash in the United States?
Yeah, I know that.
Okay. Everybody said the same thing about real estate in America. Could never go down. It's impossible.
Yeah.
Here's what happens, though, when there's housing demand fed by an attitude like that. Developers build. They build a lot. You throw in the mass urbanization here, millions of people moving from the country to the cities, and there's almost no way to build enough housing until you build too much. Our Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz reports.
It seemed like a good idea at the time. It was 2006, Shanghai. New luxurious housing developments were going up all over the place, each trying to outdo the other. One particularly bold developer said, top this, a suburb way out on the edge of Shanghai that recreates a quaint village in old England. It's got narrow cobblestone streets, a Gothic cathedral, red telephone booths, and a man-made river, the Thames. This is Thamestown. These days, it might as well be called Ghost Town. The only people I find are two workers replacing some cobblestones. I ask them if there's anyone else here. They direct me to Thamestown's rather unbustling business district. The only place open is a cafe. It's next door to a closed pub and a boarded-up fish and chip shop. Hong Fang owns this place.
My friends warned me that starting a business here would be risky. How can you make money if nobody lives here, they said. They were right. I lost money in the first 2 years. Last year, I came close to breaking even, but it looks like I'm not going to make money again this year.
5 years ago, Hong and her husband bought one of 1,600 homes in Thamestown. Since then, they've watched as speculators bought up property around them and then sat on their investments. They didn't even rent them out. Tsinghua University's Patrick Chovanec says Thamestown is a colorful example of something more serious.
For many years now, we've seen a pattern where people in China pour money into real estate, and often unproductive real estate, as a place to stash their cash.
The problem is, investors have driven up property prices to unrealistic levels. Sound familiar? Chovanec says in China's case, it goes beyond being just a real estate bubble. 70% of China's economic growth comes from building things, housing developments, high-speed train lines, things like that. This is all funded through loans from state banks. Banks that, in recent years, have been ordered by China's government to keep on lending.
It's a very seductive idea that all you have to do is simply tell banks, just go forth and lend, and you count the amount that they've lended and the amount that's poured out as GDP, and then there's your growth. And, of course, in the short term, that looks fantastic, but it's not a healthy economy. That's an economy on steroids.
Even China's national auditor says many local governments are now having a problem paying back their loans. An economist with Credit Suisse called the problem China's biggest time bomb. And some believe for places like Thamestown, the bomb has already gone off. On the empty streets, a photographer aims his camera at a couple dressed in a tux and a wedding gown. Thamestown is now one of the most popular spots in Shanghai for wedding photographs. The photographer is Aaron Huang.
I take wedding photos here every day. So does everyone else. It's the perfect place. It's empty and it looks exactly like a European town.
And back at her cafe, Hong Fang may not have any customers, but she says she loves waking up to nothing but the sound of bird singing. It's the peace and quiet of living in a developer's dream of China's limitless potential, a dream some say China may soon wake up from. In Thamestown, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Our series this week, The 5-Year Plan, takes us to China and the live broadcast we did from there in 2006. We went back last month to see what's changed for them and for us.
The real estate bubble is going to bust.
It's a game of dodgeball. Stay standing.
The ability to go from famine to gluttony in two generations.
China's part Africa and part Switzerland.
You know how we've been saying the past couple of days how fast things are changing in China? Longtime China watcher Jim McGregor says pretty much the same thing, just better.
A generation lasts 5 years because people 5 years apart are growing up in a different China.
Our story today is in two acts, two economic generations by McGregor's reckoning, starting with 36-year-old contractor Li Yongqian. On a hot, sweaty late Friday afternoon in Chongqing, we ride the 113 city bus home with Mr. Li. He's been checking progress at one of the half dozen apartment renovations he's got going on. It's about an hour on the bus tonight, faster than usual, he says. A 20-minute walk, and then 11 floors up in a tiny little elevator to his apartment. It's small, but by Chinese standards, heck, by Manhattan standards, there's plenty of room for the four of them. Yeah, four of them. They've got two boys, paid the fines under the one-child policy. And one of the kids, at least, is eager to practice his English.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm fine.
I'm fine.
You are fine. Good.
As Mr. Lee cooks dinner, his wife and I talk about how their lives have changed the past 5 years.
Life is better than before. Every day is a holiday.
Did you get that? Every day is a holiday. The Lee family is the very picture of upwardly mobile China. He brings home 8,000 yuan, about $1,200 a month. They've got a flat-screen TV, a fridge, a water cooler, two air conditioners, with a third on the list of things to buy next.
We make more money, but we spend more at the same time.
We couldn't afford anything before, but we just got the refrigerator, the TV sets, and we bought the apartment in 2007.
But it's not just the big ticket items they're spending their money on. Inflation hit a 3-year high last month when we were there, 6.5%. So the price of daily life, that's bus fare, food, all of it, is rising fast. Still, the Lees have a lot of hope about the future.
I hope my sons' lives are better than ours. I hope they can make more money, have a better job than me. I want them to go to university. I hope they can find a better employer, make money easier.
The Lees have a lot more money than just a couple of years ago, but they're still saving more than half of what he brings home. China analyst Paul French explains.
People who have been doing extremely well, who've got themselves a nice little apartment, who've got themselves a nice car, suddenly wake up tomorrow and their mum's had a stroke. Within a matter of weeks, the bank accounts of their single child are emptied. There is no net, the ability to just fall and keep on falling down until you touch an absolutely horrible rock bottom is the massive major difference between China as it is at the moment and most of the societies that we come from in the West.
It wasn't quite rock bottom, but not long after Mr. Lee's wife, Chang Jia Sheng, started up her bakery business a couple of months ago, an industrial mixer took a chunk out of her arm. $5,000 for medical expenses. No insurance. Another $12,000 down the drain from losing the business because the flour she'd bought was tainted. The risks of the relentless Chinese economy are real, but so too, says Paul French, are the possibilities.
The ability to go from famine to gluttony in two generations, well, that's a hell of an achievement. China is not going to look to its past, right? It's not a kind of country where like a lot of our countries, where we can turn around and say, you know, things were better in the past. Things were not better under Mao.
Act two of our trip through the Chinese middle class starts with 28-year-old Dora Chai.
So I would say that I would just make the best of the job and try to learn as much as I can and see where that takes me.
Dora fits the McGregor construct perfectly. She's 5 years younger than the Lees out in Chongqing. Economically, though, she's living in a different country. She's got a college degree, a great job in PR at the Chinese internet giant Alibaba that she loves, and lots of online shopping with her two credit cards.
I'm a shopaholic, and I spent a lot of money on Taobao. I'm pretty guilty about it as well.
She's got a new apartment, a cute new Peugeot 307 hatchback, and a keen awareness of what economic independence means for her future.
As young people, we are confident. We are new in this world. We want to see where our potentials are. Happiness is about, it's not about you get all the things you want. It is about you get the things that you want after you worked really hard for it.
Dora Chai and her economic generation make the place that we started today, the marriage market in Shanghai and being married by 30, seem very far away, old-fashioned even.
You are 28?
Yes.
You don't have much time left.
Why?
I don't know.
I have a lifetime left. Why? Like, when is my deadline?
I don't know.
Then why is there so much time left? Property is sort of the leverage to get you, you know, higher up in the marriage marketplace. But also, I believe in myself. I think I have the ability to make money to stand on my own feet. So it's necessary, but I don't see the rush.
She might not see the rush, but the rest of the Chinese economy sure does. Not about marriage, but about business and quality of life and those rising expectations we've been talking about all week. And therein lies another challenge for the Chinese government, says China Hand Jim McGregor.
So the government runs scared of these of their people's expectations because their only legitimacy is performance. It's not like they have an electoral legitimacy. And that's where China, when China talks about its own kind of democracy, they're not talking nonsense. That's what they really believe. They believe that they are, their form of democracy is they have to perform in order to please their citizens.
So tomorrow on the broadcast, we wrap up the five-year plan with American companies doing their best to please the citizens of the biggest market on Earth.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out, in which the Chinese give Washington a little talking to about the debt limit fiasco. A foreign ministry spokesman in Beijing said yesterday the Chinese government hopes the U.S. adopts, and this is a quote, responsible policies and measures to guarantee the interests of investors. Those investors, that's the Chinese government. Beijing holds more than $1 trillion in U.S. debt. We owe them $1 trillion is another way to say that, and they want to make sure they get paid back. All right, that's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 54 points, 0.4%. The NASDAQ off 34 points, about 1.2%. The S&P 500 down 8 points, 0.2%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here, why do you suppose Harley Davidson is doing so well in China? Well, I got two words for you. Conspicuous and consumption.
When you ride a bike, I think head turning around Shanghai with a Harley is maybe more than a Ferrari.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.